Blog Talk Radio.
Marshall, and welcome to Backyard Labyrinth. This evening, I want to say, first of all, Happy New Year, because this is our first show of the new year. We had a show just before the last day of the old year, and boy, did we have some fun talking about things we did back in the day and getting into all those memories. However, I want to welcome you on this first show of 09. And it's a very special show this evening because we have a very special guest who I'll be introducing in a minute. But I did want to welcome all our listeners. I see that our board is lighting up and we have quite a few listeners already on the phone because we know how very important what we're going to discuss this evening in the backyard is. And I'd like to tell you that our special guest, for you, those who might not have gotten our promo this evening, and you are going to have to bear with me now because I have been practicing this name for a couple of days now, and I do want to get it right. So I'll be introducing to you Dr. Ifeoma Okay, I'll let her say it because I had it all rolling off my lips and now I think I messed up. So good evening, doctor. Are you there?
Good evening, Margaret. It's Omawako.
Omawako. Did I?
Ifomawanko.
Ifomawanko. That's a beautiful name, and it was rolling off my lips, and all of a sudden, I got so excited. I couldn't say it right. Well, welcome to the show. How are you?
I am fantastic, and I am honored and thrilled to be here tonight talking with you and your listeners.
Oh, my goodness. My board is just lighting up. And I want to remind our listeners that you are listening to Backyard Labrish. Let me welcome my co-host, Donna. Donna, are you there? Hello.
Yes, I am. Thank you. And I'm looking forward to the interview today. I mean, it's going to be a very interesting subject. I've been looking at some of the information that was out on the Internet these past few days and just kind of getting a feel for the doctor's research that she's been doing and some of the clubs that she started relating to her topic. And I know she's going to have probably some of her students or co-writers or educators that are going to be probably participating. So I'm definitely looking forward to it.
Well, I just want to welcome our listeners online, too. I know we have quite a few listeners listening online. Right now my board is full. And I just want to remind our listeners that if you do want to interact with us, with me or the doctor, just hit 1 on your keyboard, and I'll put you on live for your questions. But now it's time to welcome the doctor again and ask her to tell us a little bit about ourselves. I know a lot about you from just reading your bio, and I'm so thrilled. I must tell you that first when I came across your article, I can't remember where it was, but I was intrigued because I had, during my growing up, and I grew up in Jamaica during the 40s and 50s,
mm-hmm.
I had never met an African who was born and raised in Africa and had an African name until I came to the United States in 1959.
Hmm.
Because, you know, in those days, the communication was not as good as it is now. You know, we didn't have telephones and, you know, TV. We had radio, ZQI, and Radio Jamaica. But that was about it in terms of mass communication. And, of course, the gleaner. So as we grew up in different parts of the island, we didn't interact as much as people can do that now. So forgive me because I'm a little sort of backwards where that is concerned.
Not a problem at all.
But honestly, I had my first encounter on a personal basis. You know, I read about them and I knew about them. But my first encounter with a person who was born and raised in Africa was when I came to New York.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I was very intrigued when I saw your name, and then read that you were born in Jamaica. That was very intriguing to me.
Well, I can tell you a bit about my history, my personal history, but I will tell you to begin with that what you mentioned is not uncommon. I will say that even my own grandfather called me the African. So it was quite distinctive. I was born and raised in Jamaica of a Jamaican mother and a Nigerian father who came to the U.S. to graduate school at the University of Wisconsin back in the 1960s when there was all this recruiting from the Caribbean for universities in the U.S. and Canada. And that was how I came to be. I came to the United States myself in 1986. And had completed third form at Campion College in Kingston. But I started high school over again in the U.S. at Piscataway High School in New Jersey. So New Jersey became my U.S. home.
Wow. Now, who lived in New Jersey?
My mother lives in New Jersey along with other blood and non-blood family members.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. I must say you have quite a distinctive Jamaican accent. Well, not distinctive, but I can pick it up. You know what I mean?
It depends. As you know, with us, it depends on who we're talking to and when.
You know, that's right.
it goes and comes, because sometimes I have situations where, particularly when I was living in North Carolina, where people will say things about Jamaicans or about foreigners in my presence, not recognizing necessarily that I am also.
Right, right, because of your name.
Yes.
All right. Well, that brings me to what we were, you know, what I really want to talk about tonight. Because I remembered when I came here from Jamaica in 1959,
mm-hmm.
and I was, you know, it was a little strange to me because I did not have, in those days, we did not have a lot of history in our schools about America and about what was going on here, you know, in terms of the racial crisis,
yes.
and the racial problems. And as you know, in Jamaica, especially in those days, we had people from all races, and
yes.
we were all Jamaicans. So this
yes.
actually happened to my husband and I.
Mm-hmm.
In those days, you had to, once you come and you're a resident and all, you had to register for the draft. You know,
mm-hmm.
it was not, it is compulsory. And I remember when he went to the recruiting place, for the first time, we saw a form that said, "What is your race?" You know what I mean? And I remember we were sitting in this little room, and he looked at me, and I looked at him, and I said, "Put human." Because we never had to define our race before.
Yes, yes.
And so it was very interesting. That was the first time in my life that I was exposed to that. And I'm being very honest. And I remember, you know, we just look at each other. Because we didn't know what to put. We were just Jamaicans.
So that whole thing of checking a box, right? Black,
right,
white.
Right, right, right. So, and of course, he was what we call a white Jamaican, then, let's say. He could pass or whatever they call it. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
So,
yes.
I mean, I remember people used to look at us strange in those days. I'm talking about 59 and 60.
Yes, yes.
So, and we couldn't figure out what they were looking at. You know, what the heck is going on here? Is something wrong? So it took me a little time to sort of get into the groove of what was happening.
Yes.
So I would like to know, one of the questions that I was really curious about is because I know that I am so grateful that I was born and raised in Jamaica. Really, I really, really was. I wondered how... what your feeling is of, you know, being born there and what difference it made in the way you have chosen your career and you're passionate about what you're doing. First of all, let's talk a little bit about what you're doing.
Yes. Yes. What I am doing is really gathering oral histories, gathering the histories of Caribbean communities in Latin America, focusing specifically on Caribbean community in Panama, working with community members, working with the community there to try and preserve the history of the previous generations as well as the history of the modern day generations, and using it in the schools as well as with for community education purposes.
Excellent. And one of the things I know that really touched my heart when I was reading about you is your mission,
yes.
along with your commitment to hands-on, eyes-on, and ears-on learning.
Yes.
Because I feel that is so deep. It really is. You know, it's not just learning from a book.
Yes.
And
yes.
that's what you're talking about.
Exactly that, exactly that. So many of our students go to class and people talk at them and then they are expected to learn. I'm not a proponent of that. I believe that students learn best by doing, by talking to people, by interacting directly, and by seeking knowledge themselves. And you asked what difference growing up in Jamaica had. I think the education that I had in Jamaica at Mona Primary as well as at Campion encouraged me it cultivated my curiosity. It always made me curious to find out information for myself, and I try to impart that to my students.
Oh my goodness, and I'm sure you're doing a wonderful job. Mm-hmm. Now tell us a little bit about your book.
Yes, my book is entitled Black Cosmopolitanism. It is a book that grew out of the experience of coming to the United States at the age of 13 and trying to figure out, as you said, trying to figure out the racial landscape in the United States.
Right.
It was clear to me when I arrived that I was supposed to be African American, but I also felt connected to the Indians who had migrated, as well as to the Latin Americans. And the message came to me over the years that I was in high school that clearly you are supposed to be this particular thing. So I became curious about how these different groups relate to each other. And I became curious about why someone would say to me, oh, you're not black, you're Jamaican, or why you're talking that way when you're talking African-American vernacular. So I became curious about the relationships between the groups. When I started working on my book, I decided to go back into the history, go back to the slavery era, 18th century, 19th century, to understand what the relationships between different groups of people of African descent in the U.S., the Caribbean, and Latin America were during slavery. So what is the raw material, the historical raw material that we are working with today? And so my book, Black Cosmopolitanism, focuses on differences in terms of approaches to self-definition between people of African descent in the U.S., Cuba, and the British West Indies in the wake of the Haitian Revolution.
Wow.
Well, I would just like to say something. This is Donna. I just want to say that, first and foremost, you're listening to Backyard Labrish, and I want to just say welcome to our guests that we have in our chat room. And, of course, if you want to participate, please feel free to register. You'll still be able to hear everything and then refresh, and you can ask any questions that you like. But outside of that, feel free just to continue to listen. Also, just want to say really quick that I was thinking about what you were saying, and I remember looking at something that you had, and I realized that you have an organization called Voices from Our America.
Yes.
And you have a whole team of individuals and workshops and everything that's a part of this whole partnership.
Absolutely.
And I would like to ask you about that. And two, the other thing that I saw that I thought was pretty interesting was that one of the things that you talked about was when you were talking about I think the Panamanians that were working in the canal zone, and that when they worked in the canal zone that was operated by the whites of the United States, that it was totally different than if they worked, on the other side of the zone. And I wanted you to kind of talk about that as well.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about in Panama City itself.
Right. You had done a number of, I think, interviews with people that had worked in that zone during the time, and a number of them had kind of, I guess, what I was looking at was the fact that when they were working in that area, if they worked up under the area that was operated by the whites in the U.S., it seems that they really got a chance to really understand what Jim Crow was about.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of similar to what we were experiencing here, whereas those people that worked in the other zone really probably didn't experience the same thing.
Right. Well, let me say two things. First of all, Voices from Our America is an innovative research, curriculum development, and community education project that is focused right now in Panama, but we also have other sites. The Panamanian project manager is named Nyasha Warren, and we have several other team members in Panama who have been working with us. We have now completed 100 interviews in Panama with people of a variety of ages and a variety of generations, and we have participated and partnered with local organizations to do about 18 different events and to have educational workshops over the course of the last 2 years. So when I was talking earlier about gathering history and making it useful in the community and in the schools, the way that I primarily do that is through the Voices from Our America project, which is a very collaborative endeavor.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. So the answer to your second question about Panamanians in the canal zone, one of the things that has been very interesting, and there are a few other scholars who have written about this as well, is that there was racism on both sides. So it's not just that there was racism on the canal zone, on the U.S. canal zone. Now, certainly that was an organized racism because you had the silver roll and the gold roll. It was separate. People got different levels of pay. People had different housing. People had different treatment based on their race. So that was kind of very straight Jim Crow. But on the Panamanian side, you also have, particularly with the 1941 Constitution, discrimination. And so the people that we have talked to, a number of them have talked about the discrimination on the Panama side as well.
Oh, wow. That's pretty interesting because I really didn't know that, you know, when most times as an American, when you hear about, you know, the islands and you don't really hear about the racial aspect of it, you always assume that once they were free, that, you know, they didn't have the same type of oppressions that we had here mm-hmm. in the United States.
Right, right. And in the Panamanian case, it was legalized. I mean, it was became part of the Constitution for a moment. That did not last, but it was there. And so there are poets like Carlos Guillermo Wilson who write about that. He has a poem called Iratus in which he talks about the how disgusted he was to not be a citizen, even though you are there. And there are other people that we've talked to have talked about the fact that you're, because of that discrimination on both sides, you were neither a U.S. citizen nor a Panamanian citizen. So it created a middle ground that you had to find your way in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Interesting, because, you know, we've had, as a matter of fact, I see that my caller from New York, 718-379, I think visited Panama recently, and I see that somebody wants to talk. I'll let them in. Good
Hello.
Evening. This
Hi
is
there.
Welcome back at Labrish.
Hi, Donna. Hi, Margaret.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Doctor.
Hello.
Yeah. You know, as one who visits Panama regularly, and I took an interest in some of the things that happened to West Indians, particularly Jamaicans, after the 1914, when the canal was officially opened. My friends who take me around and show me things from a historical perspective brought up exactly what you are saying, and since this project was mainly, the Panama Canal project was mainly an American project, of course they brought their way of life, to put it in a euphemistic form, with them. And so the things that you would expect to see in the South and in the Army was pervasive in Panama. I'm very well aware of that. So,
do you think it was more so in Panama than in Jamaica?
I would say so, because
we
didn't have, in Jamaica, we didn't have the same kind of American pilot influence as they did in Panama.
I got you.
So Jamaica was, don't forget, we were British.
Right.
And the British, they, as far as slavery is concerned, they sprung us. So to use
I learned something quite interesting when I came here. You know, I made it my duty to do some research, because I was so green as to, you know, why certain behaviors was different and why there was this emotional feeling of being a second-class citizen, which I never felt. And I had no fears at the time of going for anything that I wanted, going any place. I mean, I wouldn't think twice, I suppose, because I didn't know better. But
well, Margaret, it's I think if you would stick a pin there, as we say, we from Jamaica, not having the same historical background as the people in Panama or the people in when I say people, you know who I mean, the black,
right.
In the South, we do not carry that baggage of realizing or feeling that you're a second-class citizen. I went through the army here, and
what year was that?
The early 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And it never occurred to me then that I should feel subservient to anybody.
Right.
Even though in the army you have a structured society, and it's basically your superiors are, you have to live with that because that's the way the army is structured.
Mm-hmm.
But what you just said prior, that the feeling of a second-class citizen, I don't think I had that feeling ever.
Never entered your mind.
No.
Right.
So,
but were you treated differently because you were of brown skin?
Maybe for another program, but I happened to be
light skin.
A flight leader. this is a designation that it started when I enlisted for the Air Force, and it just turned out that I enlisted at Times Square, and a fellow who I saw but didn't realize who he was until we got on the train and met, because we enlisted on the same day at the same place. This guy was a German with an accent. Now, we traveled together, this German and I, down to San Antonio, Texas. And on the train, we met a Puerto Rican fellow who spoke, English, but haltingly. And it turned out that when we got into training, the German was made the flight leader, I was made his assistant, the Puerto Rican was made my assistant. So they called us, our flight the Foreign Legion. And within this Foreign Legion, you had men that accosted me and asked me, who do I think I am? You see, but that is like water in a duck's tail. I'm in charge, you see. So
now, were there people of color that were in?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. All righty.
Yeah. You know, and I spoke with a different accent, and so who do I think I am? You know.
Right. Right.
Was the question.
Yeah.
So that. Different experiences, but how you handle it is also a trademark of where you're coming from.
Right, right, and that's what I wanted to find out more from the doctor as to how she believes that this influenced her, her passion, and actually just how she interacted. Being between both countries.
Well, I was 13 years old, and at 13, basically your question is, what do I need to do to fit in? So at that age, I made some unconscious decisions about blending into U.S. culture, but I continued to be connected with Jamaica, and I'm a big fan, and I'm of Louise Bennett.
Uh-huh.
So I continue to stay grounded in Miss Lou and in Jamaican patois poetry and in that history and that culture. So the effect, even though I was I'm becoming American in terms of speech and in culture in some ways, I remained grounded in Jamaica-ness because of Louise Bennett specifically.
I got you. You know, that's interesting. I find that quite interesting because when in the 40s, when we were growing up, we would go to the pantomime and, of course, you know, really enjoy it then. But
yes.
Really, we were not, it was not welcomed in our homes as our regular way of speaking.
Correct.
As I think it is sometimes more acceptable now, you know, since independence.
Sometimes it is more acceptable now.
Right.
I would say since independence, for instance, when I went to school, we couldn't speak Patois. And,
right.
You know,
I was
on the debating society and stuff like that, and we did dramatics at school as well. And it wouldn't occur to anybody to have a play in Patois, in vernacular, I should say.
Yeah.
So, excuse me, did you have that same experience? Because I noticed that you said you are a product of Campion College. Now that
so I know how to speak the Queen's English, right?
Yes, well,
I know how to perform my Claude McKay poetry
and
all of my Longfellow and all of one of the things that's interesting to me is the connection now that has come that has arisen between Patois or people who speak Patois and that kind of training and that kind of background. So if you think about Beanie Man, the dance hall artist, he has a line in his song where he says, "The heights that great men reached and kept." And as we know, that's from the classic poetry that we had to memorize.
Yes.
We had to memorize as children. So it was never, the society, Jamaican society, was not never as split linguistically as those in power wanted to believe. As you said yourself, Margaret, you spoke Patois, you knew how to do it, but you weren't supposed to.
Right.
So there was always a Patois literacy that was there, that was undergirding everything that we did. And now it's just beginning to come out more, thanks to people like Carolyn Cooper and, of course, to Miss Lou. And you mentioned the pantomimes with Leonie Forbes and Charles Hyatt and all of these important people. So for me, growing up, you mentioned the pantomimes. Those were absolutely crucial to remaining grounded in Jamaican culture.
Right. But you grew up during the Manly days, I think you mentioned in some of the papers.
And that's where the Spanish came from, right? Because during that era, the late 70s, early 80s, they were beginning to make connections. And we had the option of taking either Spanish or civics. So in first form at Campion, I had the option, and I started Spanish when I was 10. And so that's why I'm even able to do this work in Panama, is because of Michael Manley and the move that the Caribbean was making at that time.
I see. Very good. I see my board is full, and I'd like to remind our callers that if you'd like to interact with us, please hit 1 on your keyboard. And I'm sure that the doctor is open for questions, right?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, and you're listening to Backyard Labrish. And we do have a website, the www.backyardlabrish.com. And we're inviting everybody from all cultures to go register and hang out with us in the backyard. You can build a profile. It works just like Facebook. For you young folks that know what Facebook does, I'm still sort of discovering it. But you can do the same thing in the backyard, only with us. You have the cultural fling part of it because we're just hanging out, enjoying the breeze and interacting with people from different cultures. But part of what we want to do, as I would like to explain to the doctor, is leave some footprints about the way we grew up in the 40s and 50s, you know, because things are changing all over the world as they are in Jamaica. And if there's not some personal stories, you know, all you have is the historical facts.
Absolutely.
Of what went on.
Yes.
But you don't really, the personal stories are much more passionate and real.
I will say amen to that. And my whole mission with Voices from Our America is to do exactly that, but also to begin gathering the stories of the younger generations now so that 20, 30, 40, 50 years from now, we're not saying, oh, it's about to be lost and we have to catch it.
Yes, because I think that has happened with so many people from my time. Because as some of my listeners know, you know, I had a lot of things from my mother that I thought I would pass on, you know, letters and different things to my grandchildren. But I had a house fire. I've lost everything. And it's that is part, along with taking a trip to Europe, my first trip to Europe, and actually stayed in Madrid in a bed and breakfast and was just so intrigued as to how that family that I stayed with had passed on their culture even to the younger generation. Their grandchildren were learning a lot more and doing things that were done from generations before. And
yeah.
I came back to the States and said, oh, my goodness, what are my grandchildren going to know about me? And my grandchildren are pretty young.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to be raised on the computer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I figure we need to retain these stories because they're never lost when they're in cyberspace.
Right, right.
And I'm encouraging the older generation. That's why I'm so proud of our caller from New York, because he happens to be my cousin and he's older than me.
And I went to St. George's, doctor. So.
Oh, you did? Oh, okay. George's. My whole family is KC. So.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. And where in Jamaica did you grow up?
Mona Heights in Kingston.
Oh, yes. You're a Kingstonian, as we call that.
All through and through. Through and through.
Yes, well, so is Leigh and myself. We're Kingstonians. And I live in Atlanta, Georgia. And have been living here since the 80s. However, you know, I've lived in New York and Florida.
Mm-hmm.
I think I have some of my Florida listeners on, too. And remember, if you ever want to interact with us, if you're online, just dial in on your telephone and interact with us. I think the number, Donna, you want to give the number out for me, please?
Oh, yes, I'd be happy to do that. I wanted to also just, again, welcome our guests that are in the chat room and let them know that if you want to ask a question or participate in the conversation, please feel free to do so. Also, our call-in number is 718-766-4558. And please make sure that you go to backyardlabbers.com and log in and leave a profile. I know that we have a number of callers that are raising their hands, but I'll give it back to you, Ms. Margaret.
Okay. And caller from 770-572 would like to interact with us, so I'm opening up the mic. Welcome. This is Margaret. Welcome to the backyard. Who am I speaking with? Hello? Caller with your raised hands, you're open. The mic is open. I guess they just still want to be silent.
Hello.
Hello, yes.
Yes, hi, Ms. Margaret. How you doing?
Hi there. Who do we have online? Who do we
this
have on
there? This is Miss Esther.
And where are you speaking, calling from, Esther?
I'm calling from Austell, Georgia.
Oh, great. And welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I've been, really intrigued with the information that I've been listening to on the call. I really appreciate that you have, people like the doctor and real life experiences about, you know, our history and helping us to understand who we can identify with. I'm of Puerto Rican descent. Absolutely. And I'm also Irish.
Happy Three Kings Day from New York.
I'm sorry?
Happy Three Kings Day from New York.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm from New York, too, so that was good.
Was a big parade yesterday.
Absolutely, I know. And I was thinking about what you guys were saying about, you know, identifying, you know, who do you identify with? And I believe I identify with all three. You know, I'm Puerto Rican. My mom, you know, I mean, I grew up doing relaxes on my mom's hair, you know. My grandmother, you know, is dark. My brother, if we were standing next to each other, most people, would never know that he's my brother because I'm light and he's dark. I believe that everyone is mixed in one shape or another. I mean, between, you know, the African sign over and then the West Indies and the Caribbean and everything all mixing together. And then you have the Spanish and then you have the Irish and then you have the whites and then you have, you know, you're just mixing all together. I believe everyone has a little bit of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that it's a good thing, you know, because it creates diamonds. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but, I mean, our elected president is half white and half black. I mean, is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay. So doing that would only, you know, help our human race become better because
yeah.
we can find the best of both, okay,
yeah.
and be able to identify with the best of both.
Yeah.
You know, we're growing outside the box. I mean, the box of stereotypes. I mean, you had, you know, mentioned about, you know, you had to identify when you're doing your survey whether you're black or white. You know, now you have black, you have white, you have Hispanic, you have non-Hispanic, you have Asian. I mean, if I were to fill in some bubbles, I would put black, I would put white, I would put Hispanic. You know, I'm all three. You know,
I just put human.
I'm sorry?
I said I usually just put human.
Yeah. The human, yeah.
That's my race. I'm in the human race.
Well, isn't it true that the census now has a new designation? It isn't just plain black or white.
No, black non-Hispanic, white non-Hispanic, and then under the Hispanic, they have different races now.
And they have other.
Yes.
So what is other?
Other. You know, mutt, maybe, you know. A little bit of both.
Let me say, I really appreciate what you said, because in particularly in terms of the Caribbean, it's such a mixture there. Where you're talking about Puerto Rico, the Dominican Republic,
mm-hmm.
it's just such a mixture. One of the interesting things to think about is that in the U.S., Beyonce and J-Lo are under different racial categories.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at their blood, their ancestry, the way they look the same.
Right.
You know, they have African, they have European, they have Taino or indigenous somewhere, but in the U.S. we put them in different categories somehow.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
And you know something I want to share, one more thing. I had the privilege of taking my mom and my grandma to Puerto Rico.
Mm.
They haven't been there for some 15, 30 years. And we had went to this museum. A history in Ponce.
I've been there, yes.
Me too.
Yeah, and it was interesting, you know, how you can connect, you know, all the different shades that we have by, you know, the Europeans coming, the Latinos, you know, the Indians are already here. The Europeans came, you know, they used them up. You know, and then they needed more people, and then they went to Africa and then got them and bring them over here. And, you know, then that went, you know, down and slavery was over, and then there was the immigration port. And then you had, you know, all different types of Germans and Italians and, you know, Caribbean, you know, from every which part of the world. That was the port to get into the United States. So, I mean, you have so much of a variety, and some people even just stayed in Puerto Rico and lived in Puerto Rico and married in Puerto Rico and you know, all that mixed and happened. So it kind of, like, painted the picture of how you can trace back and know that you identify with all three. And, you know, I believe that eventually everybody will look Puerto Rican.
Todos somos boricua.
I want to ask the doctor really quick, do you have a website?
Not yet, but it will be coming within the next month. It's in development.
Well,
right.
I want to Yeah, well, I know that Ms. Margaret has probably kind of hinted to it or talked to you about it, but you have so, you know, many areas that we can labrish on, and I hope that we'll have you on within, you know, maybe, you know, next couple of months, you know, next month, a month after, and just kind of talk about some of the other things, particularly your book, and hopefully by then, you know, or during that time frame when your website comes up, then you'll share that with us, and we can share that with our listeners and get that out there for you.
Absolutely.
Okay, my board is really full, and I'd like to invite our listeners that want to ask the doctor a question or make a comment on our intercultural relationships that we're discussing this evening. Just hit 1 on your telephone, and I'll know that you want to be live.
Well, I just want to also say that I know that you have a number of classes that you're doing there at Vanderbilt, and one of them I was looking online. It said something about Black multiculturalism.
Yes,
that was like really in line with what you're talking about. I mean, or Latin, you know. And I, you know, really when you think about it, you know, and I was talking earlier, I was saying to myself, what, you know, how do you really, you know, you got African American, you got Latino, you got Caribbean, West Indian, you know, I mean, who falls into what category? And, you know, you don't want to cross, you know, say the wrong thing, because I know some Hispanics don't want to be called Latinos and Latinos don't want to be called Hispanics, and you're like, I really don't want to cross over. But then how do you really, you know, relate to a person, like you said, you know, are Latinos like Sammy Sosa Black? You know, in America, or you know, was Biggie an African American or West Indian since his mother's from Jamaica, or, you know, Colin Powell Jamaican parents, you know, African American, Latin American, or Caribbean, you know, so, you know, when you evaluated that with your students, I mean, how does that come out?
It's a class that the students always enjoy because it puts the question up front, and it doesn't make, we don't make the assumption, right, that we know what people are. We spend the semester asking the question. So when you interact with people, from my perspective, each person is an individual, and each person makes decisions about his or her own identity based on the particular circumstances of his or her bringing up, and as Margaret and I were talking about earlier, the particular context that you're in at the moment. So there may be some context where you identify one way and another context where you identify another way. So in terms of the relationships, the historical relationships between all of these different groups, really the groups are something are things that were created for economic reasons, and there are several scholars that talk about this, because the U.S. needs to categorize people in particular ways at particular moments to make the economics flow better. So the whole notion of Black, the whole notion of Latino at particular points in the U.S. history has to do with that. There's one student who did a research project out of that class, and he followed up on it this semester. His great-grandfather had migrated to the U.S. from Mexico. And when he migrated to the U.S., he was classified as white. But by the same token, he was Mexican. And the grandfather made a decision never to speak Spanish, not to teach his children or grandchildren Spanish. And this young man now is so curious about his history, but his history was lost. His history was cut. Because of his grandfather's understanding of U.S. racial categories.
Wow.
You know, that's really interesting. I was sharing with someone today the same thing. I have a girlfriend who I've known for, gosh, a long time when I think about it, over almost 30 years. And the same thing happened for her. Her family came in from Mexico. And her father and mother, even when I met them, could barely speak English, but she could speak no Spanish whatsoever. None of her brothers or sisters could speak Spanish. They weren't allowed to speak it in their house, regardless of the fact that they weren't really communicating with their family, their parents. They were not allowed. And even to this day, she cannot really even. And I'm going to tell you something. You have Esther on the phone from Puerto Rican descent who cannot speak really any Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of people, you know, that come that want to become, you know, they want to be Americanized and they want to take on American culture. So, you know, they make a real conscious decision to say, well, my children aren't going to speak Spanish because that's going to hold them back, as opposed to realizing that it bridges them to their past and to their history.
And I want to ask you a question though. You said that your father came from Nigeria to Jamaica, and you know
they met here, right?
Yes, correct. In the U.S.
Paula would like to ask a question, but finish your question, Donna.
So I'm used to Jamaicans traveling everywhere, and
yes.
We do.
And so I was like, wow, he went to Jamaica, but he came here, and then they went to Jamaica.
There was I was born in Jamaica, but they stayed here. My mother went back and forth.
Ah, okay, I got you. Okay, that was one of the things that I was kind of curious about.
Yeah.
Many Nigerians that have come to the United States and various, even Hawaii, as you know, with Barack Obama, you know, a lot of Africans will go, in the United States. But I hadn't really heard of very many, would have actually, gone to Jamaica. I've heard of Jamaicans going everywhere, so I thought that was pretty interesting.
There were some. There's a graduate student here in the history department here at Vanderbilt who's actually doing research on that, on Africans going to Jamaica. So
interesting. Hey. I see quite a few callers want to ask a question, so I'm putting through 404-512. You're live.
This is Mabel. Good evening, everyone. This is Mabel.
Hi,
hey,
Doma.
Hey, my
name.
Hey, Isoma. Is Isoma still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. Nice to meet you. Hi there.
Hi. Isoma Kekime.
Oh, see, all I know is Kedu.
Oh, my goodness.
Because that's a whole nother. I don't even talk about that history because it's my Nigerian side. I'm not in contact with it.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Do you know if he's Igbo, Yoruba, or Hausa?
Even though my name is Ifeoma Chinwe Wankwo, so Nigerian, so Igbo.
It's Igbo. It's
totally.
Igbo.
And everybody, my friends from Senegal and everywhere else tell me I'm very Nigerian. You know what? And you know what? That they don't necessarily always think that's a good thing because I'm very strong and I tell my opinion.
Wow. Well, when she mentioned your name, I said that you are... Most likely you're from Anambra State. I mean, your dad is from Anambra State.
He's Enugu.
Exactly. See, not Enugu, it would be Oka side.
Mm-hmm.
Because Enugu people, they don't answer Wankwo.
That's...
Yeah, it's Anambra that answers Wankwo, like old Okaluku government.
All of that. Mm-hmm. That is so interesting to me. Wow.
Very interesting. 404-551. The mic is open to you. Who am I speaking with?
Hi, Margaret. I am Charmaine Joan.
Oh, hi, Charmaine. Welcome to the show. Tell our callers where you're calling from.
I'm Charmaine Joan. Yes, and I'm calling from Atlanta.
Uh-huh.
And I just got home and was listening to the show here, so I missed the first part of it. But to Dr. Nwanko, did I pronounce it right? Did I pronounce your name right? The doctor.
Doctor, are you there? Hello?
Uh-oh.
Hello? I hope we didn't lose her.
Here.
Okay. Our caller wanted to know if she pronounced your name right.
It was perfect.
Oh,
great. I have a thing for calling people's name correctly.
And forgive me for forgetting to call yours right.
Well,
not a problem. It's been many years that I've had it, so I don't worry about those things.
That's okay. I have a particular thing about culture and what we're called. I was very interested to know that I didn't know that America did classifications for the workforce. You said, I think.
Yes.
To know who to, I guess, to put, to give the higher paying jobs to, and who to keep on the low end of the totem pole.
Yes.
Wow.
And, something here, I'm so glad you said that. I didn't know, and I'm glad I learned that. Because for me here, I will say to people that I am not black.
Mm-hmm.
And they think that how I am misguided or want to be something else. And I said, my skin color is brown.
Mm-hmm.
It is a chocolate color brown. The roots of most of my hair.
Most, you said.
Yeah. I raise it. You know, give me a few gray. And, you know, it's black. But my culture, I am Jamaican of primary African heritage. Now, I do have in my granduncle. Yeah, my late granduncle, you know, a direct kind of Scottish lineage, and you can see most of my families are very kind of light-skinned, maybe you call them Puerto Rican or whatever, you know.
I see. Mm-hmm.
And that kind of a hue. And I always said that what is, until you can tell me where black land is and where white land is, then I will call myself black. But I would say even America, I you know, you say African-American. And
mm-hmm.
the other day I thought about this sometime last year about this, and I said, we in Jamaica, we say we're Jamaicans, and then we may say, you know, Chinese heritage or whatever. And I think maybe if America would say, call, you know, people who are born here would say, I am American of African heritage or of European heritage or you know, Italian heritage and all the like, so that, oh, that's where your heritage is, but you're American and you're not a color. Because if you
well, the
black and white,
yes,
it's gray,
mm-hmm.
and Barack doesn't look gray, and that's Halle Berry. You know what I'm saying? And I think if we got away from this color thing, which is the wrong color anyway, it's an erroneous representation, and we call ourselves black because the Europeans call themselves white, so we figure we're opposite, so we said black. And so I have a issue with that. If we got away from just from color and start to say, look, this is my culture. I'm American of so-and-so culture, or, you know, I'm Jamaican of whatever, you know, we have more in common, and then the conversation would be richer than just saying, oh, I'm a black person or I'm a white person.
Yes. I think that the view you've expressed is very common among Caribbean people, and that's one of the sources of tension between Caribbean people and U.S. born people of African descent.
Exactly what I want to talk about. No, because
Very much so. Hello?
Yes. Go ahead.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes, you're there, Lay. We can hear you.
Yeah. See, this goes back. This goes into another part of history where the quote-unquote black American migrated from being called Negro to black over a period of time. So who knows? At one stage, it was colored.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. And frankly,
you know. In another 25 years or so, who knows what the, maybe they'll come to the Jamaican way of thinking, as you were,
right.
the last caller was
mm-hmm.
intimating, yes.
But there's a way that Jamaicans had access to being Jamaican in a way that U.S. blacks did not always have access to being U.S., and so our approach to identity came out differently.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's what I
true.
Was going to mention, because I remember saying to someone, you know, I didn't know I was black until I got here. I'm not talking about color, but just as being identified or labeled, you know, because I just always thought of myself as Jamaican.
Yes.
And I had friends and family of all shades of the rainbow. So we never looked at them, you know, as being any different. They were all Jamaicans.
I just want to add, this is Donna, and I just want to say that, you know, well, to give you an idea, my, you know, I'm pretty, you know, light skin, and a lot of people think that I'm Puerto Rican if I don't say very much.
Hmm.
And and my father, you know, is, you know, kind of pretty much biracial, but. You know, and being brought up in the South, it really didn't matter what you thought you were. My grandfather owned his own farm, had, you know, 9 children. They had their own, you know, they were pretty much self-employed. But it really didn't matter how he felt about himself in the South, because of the fact that there were people that would come and they would – burn down whatever he had. They would threaten the children to hang them. It didn't really matter, you know, if you wanted to live in Georgia, in the south of Georgia. And even there's times now you can go in certain areas right now, and if you you know, if you go with the wrong, you know, in the wrong spot, and they feel that you're a little bit too haughty, they will come in the middle of the night and they will put something in your yard and they will threaten your family. So, and coming up as a child, my father was a dentist, and there were times when I saw things that I just really didn't understand, and I was told, do not say anything, because once I said something, then that meant the whole family had to get involved, and they would bring their shotguns out and line them up, all the men, at nighttime, because they knew that something was going to happen. And so it wasn't necessarily what that person thought that they were, or whether they felt that they should bow their head or whatever, but it was what you were told and how you were threatened if you didn't do certain things, and how people lost their lives. And they used to call it low-hanging fruit, because they would hang these men on the trees, mm-hmm. and they would hang low, and they would have picnics like they were fruit trees up under these men that they've hung on these trees. So, you know, yeah. It's
so lynching. Much,
yeah.
Exactly. And it was a prominent thing. It wasn't something that was just, you know, periodic. And it would be for the most strangest of things. You could be walking down the street, look over, and maybe the guy in the car felt that you looked at him wrong, and he would go get his buddies, and it was time for him to find that person and lynch him. And it was very little that would be done about it.
Exactly.
And so,
yes.
So it's kind of like, you know, And I guess that's the thing, is that you know it's so hard when people say, well, you know, you're in America, you're so privileged, and so why do you have this problem? And you know, and I don't understand, you know, the process of course not. I can't understand what the Palestinians are going through right now, because I'm not living through what they're going through. But I do know that until I walk into their shoes, I really can't stand back and say, well, you ought to be ashamed of yourself for putting up with the fact that they've shut your store down and you can't feed your family.
Exactly.
And so it's a much bigger picture. But that doesn't mean that you don't walk outside of that environment and say to yourself, I'm much better than this. I know I can do better, and I'm not going to let anybody beat me down as I walk through life, but I also have to realize that I'm preserving my life by dealing with the customs. If I went to Saudi Arabia, I better wrap my head up and put on, you know, a thobe or something to cover my arms, or else I'm walking in that society. So, again, it's like if you're in Rome, you better learn how to do as the Romans do, or you will end up in a different position.
Donna, you are so right, particularly in terms of the history of the United States. And people think it's just the South, right?
We're talking about places like Boston and other places
that have that history, and people in the U.S. carry that memory.
Right.
And if you talk to the older generations, they very much carry that history and memory. And do you see the tears in their eyes because of Obama's election, because they remember that?
Well, Doctor, right now they're trying a case of four youngsters who attacked guys during the election.
Yes.
You may have heard of that, the case.
Mm-hmm.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
I can hear you.
Yeah.
Right here in New York.
That is open for 404-512-770-941 and 770-572. You're all live. I see hands raised, but I want to tell you that you're all live if you would like to say something or ask.
Actually, what I wanted to say,
I would like to be able to say that when I think of in America, a thought occurred to me here. When you are divorced or separated from your culture, the only thing that you can use to identify yourself is what you see.
Mm.
And I think maybe that's why America is preoccupied with referring to themselves as a color, erroneous color at that, but identifying you colored. And frankly, I think colored black and whatever, colored is probably the best way to identify a race of people, because we're shades of brown and so on. And so I think that once you are divorced from your culture, you can only identify yourself by color, because you have nothing else as a to use as a basis for self-identification. And if we start to respect each other's culture and really not feel ashamed, because you still have people who are ashamed to be called, they don't want to be called African, you know, because they still have a backward view of what Africa, what it means to be African, and their sense of history is not really huge. And so therefore, yeah, I'm black and I'm proud. Well, you know, to me that just sounds like something you had to say to make who you think you are be all right. You follow what I mean?
Since
yes. And I'm going to say, yeah, I'm black and I'm proud. Yeah, I'm this and that, you know, as a kind of a, to fight back. But I am not black, but I'm a proud, proud Jamaican of multicultural heritage, if you will, because of the immediacy in my family. And I'm a Caribbean woman, not a West Indian woman. That's Columbus's mistake. So I'm a Caribbean woman. You know, I get very things like that. And on that census thing, I put multicultural because I'm not a minority. I don't know what it means to be a minority. What does that mean? These words are used to put you, to psychologically put you down. You're a minority. You're a color. And then when you look in the dictionary for the meaning of these colors, the black is never considered good and everything white. You know, when I was a child, I remember seeing a sign on in Jamaica, in New Kingston there in Jamaica, and it says, "Do you want to be in the black?" It was a bank, and I'm thinking, why would you want to be in the black? serious thing, and I asked my mother, and she told me what it meant. But that's to let you understand my conditioning of what
yes.
it meant to be black
right.
was negative. So why would you want to be black, you see? So we get away, and I think maybe with Barack Obama in, the man is not a black man, and he's not a white man. The man is multi-ethnic, multicultural, or, you know, multicultural, because what is bi-race? You know, what is we're of one race, human race. And
back to what I put down.
Right.
Yeah, I got it right long ago.
It's a biracial thing. Yeah. he's not biracial. His mother did not... His mother did not procreate with an animal, and so therefore it's she appropriated with another member of the human race. So he's multicultural or bicultural, if you will. You know, so that's my take on it.
Well, thank you very much for your comments.
Thank
we appreciate
you.
It.
And thank you, Doctor.
Thank you, Charmaine. That's a brilliant analysis about the separation and the appearance.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask any of our listeners, especially listeners from the Caribbean or another country, if when they came to the United States first, they had any issues. Perhaps they were very, you know, minor, but if there were any intercultural issues, especially with black Americans. Anybody want to weigh in on that?
Well, I think it wasn't Lay saying something about that, I think.
They wanted to beat me up all the time.
Well, I have Colin from 770-572. Did you want to weigh in on that question? 572 just raised a hand.
Yeah, you said that. Do you repeat the question again just to make sure
I'm
clear?
The question was, I know that when I came here in the early 60s, late 50s, there were times when I think some of my things I did or said was misunderstood, mainly by some of my black American friends. You know,
okay.
I don't know if it had anything to do with color, but I certainly knew it had to do with culture, you know, because I was coming from a different culture where I didn't see color as much as they did. So, you know,
I'm sorry?
No, I said there were times when there was misunderstandings between us. Doctor, did you uncover any of that in your research?
Yes, very much. In my personal life, as well as in my research, you can go all the way back that there have always been those misunderstandings between African-American, U.S. African-American, and Caribbean populations, because as you all have pointed out, we have such different histories and different ways of understanding ourselves.
So as I mentioned, some people
saying those foreigners and the ongoing discussion within the African-American community about foreigners. There's been a history of foreigners, quote-unquote, taking the jobs because there's a small pie and everybody is fighting over one piece.
Did you want to say something?
No, I just wanted to say, even the way we speak, we're criticized. We take a lot of flack, you know. People, the accent, some people like it and some people don't. Most people do.
Well, one thing I want to say is that being a black person here in America, one of the things that happened, of course, it was long before color. There were other words that were used, of course, before you got to the color point. And really it was because of the fact there were so many hues of black people based upon, the racial, mixing. And then when James Brown came along, James Brown said, there's so many negativities behind the fact that, we're called Negro or colored or whatever, that we should be proud of the fact that we're black and just call ourselves black. And so then he brought out that song, Just Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. And so people kind of rallied around that theme. And, of course, you had the Black Panthers and you had a lot of people that came out of, that sense of pride of being black and, canvassing or canvassing your own community and being responsible for your own community and things like that. And one of the things that I realized at some point was that even myself, I don't want you to think that it's just being from the Caribbean or West Indian or Puerto Rican or whatever that you're going to encounter certain things amongst the, black race here in America. You have to realize that you have black people that have been so repressed or depressed or however you want to put it, that misery loves company, and they don't really want you to feel that you're better than them. Mm-hmm. And so here I am, a person who's traveled. My father's in the service, and so I've traveled around, and I would go. I remember my father, when he went to Vietnam, my mother moved back home with her family, and I was put in a public school. My first time going to a predominantly black school. I had always gone to integrated schools. And so when I went to that school, man, I was going to be beat up because I raised my hand to answer a question. And who do I think I was, the smarty pants with the proper accent? I was trying to talk proper. And so what I did was probably similar to what you did at 13 years old, is I said, okay, let me figure out how I can just kind of get along and emulates with, my folks here, so I don't get beat up. I won't raise my hand too much. I'll just kind of ask the teacher later some of the questions that I want, and things like that. But, it's just the idea that here you are and you're thinking that you're better, so I'm going to bring you down to my level. And that's a misery loves company type of situation that we encounter, even not just as, people of color, but also men and women. Women experience it with some men that don't want them to, excel. And so that's expressed in so many various levels of our society.
Human beings are complex, and people of African descent particularly so, because of the histories, yes.
Yes, yes. And, of course, Roots is a great story to look at to, to get a kind of a general idea of some of the things that transpired,
Well, I want to remind our listeners, if you're listening to Backyard Labrish on Blog Talk Radio, this is Margaret, and our guest this evening is, and I'm going to get it right this time. I'm looking on my pronunciation paper here, doctor, so please bear with me. Our special guest this evening is our charming and enlightening Dr. Ifeoma?
Wonkwo, yes.
Wonkwo. Oh, yeah, I got the first one right, Wonkwo.
And it's a pleasure having you here, Dr. Wanko. And I would like to have you back because this the board has been just lit up. A lot of people listening, and we have people listening online. We want to welcome all our listeners and tell you we are here each week. And because I'm going to say now that the doctor is one of our island people,
mm-hmm.
If my African friend is on, Mabel, you are still on? If you are on, no, I'm not discriminating against you. But I thought when I saw her name that she was pure African, and that made me sort of intrigued because I said, I've never met a Jamaican. I've never met a Jamaican, which is true. In my day, you know, when I grew up there back in the day, with two African names. Honestly.
Yes.
I mean, I'm being honest. Just like I told you, I never met a person in Jamaica while I was growing up that was born and raised in Africa.
Right.
Until I came to the States, I never met anyone like that.
Yeah.
So are your parents still alive?
Both my parents are still alive as far as I know. I have not, I'm not in touch with my father, but as far as I know, he's still alive. My mother is still alive and probably listening.
Oh, great. Well, we'd like to welcome Mama for producing this very, very interesting person.
But in terms of the cultural, there are so many different cultures and communities in terms of the populations of African descent, and they're always, always in contact. And there's so many similarities between Jamaican culture and Nigerian culture anyway.
Right.
They're very connected, and the connection is very clear.
Well, before we go off the air, Doctor, I'd like to tell you some interesting facts that I learned, which perhaps I'm sure you can perhaps verify or, you know, let me know better.
Sure.
But I was so confused when I came here first as to the difference between myself, you know, and my, as they call themselves at that time, black sisters and brothers, that I decided to really do some research. And there was a professor doing some studies on just similar to what you are doing, where they were researching what happened to the slaves that went to the West Indies, particularly in Jamaica. And what I found out, that because I came here with my hands lined with bangles, you know, perhaps six of them, and black Americans weren't wearing those things.
And
they were like part of me, you know. As a matter of fact, I still have them, some of them. But however, I learned that the slaves that were taken to Jamaica in particular, that the families were not separated. You know, they captured the young ones. They stayed with their parents. They did not take their religious ornaments away from them, which were their drums, of course, and, you know, whatever they used to worship. That's why we had, what do we call it again, obia. You know, we grew up around obia and the witch doctor. That I suppose they would call it the witch doctor. We call it the obia woman or the obia man.
Yeah.
And the pokomania, which I think was really rooted in all of that descending from the African culture.
Right.
Also, what I found is that I found that some of my peers were alarmed if they were talking about a young person, especially a male, that was still at home. You know, that boy is 30 years old and he's still living with his mama. And I'm thinking, that's what we do in Jamaica. Only to find out, not only because the island was small, but families were kept together.
Yeah.
You know, they were not separated. Of course, we know that because they kept their drums, they could communicate with other slaves all over the island. And that's why slavery was up. That's part of the reason slavery was abolished there 50 years before it was here in the United States.
Right, because of the Maroons, right.
Right. And the communication, the method of communication, which was their drums.
Right. The point you make about the slavery and the way that the differences between slavery in Jamaica and in the U.S. is a significant one. But I do want to say that if you think about it, 95% of the people who were brought as slaves from Africa were brought to places south of the United States. And then they were seasoned, what they call seasoned, that is, as if people are pieces of meat, seasoned and then sent to the United States. So 95% of the people were brought to Brazil, Jamaica, and everywhere south. So it was the families that got to stay that had the experience that you were talking about of being kept together.
Right.
But the seasoning that took place and then the populations that were sent to the United States were split apart. As you know, there are also sites in the United States, such as the Sea Islands and New Orleans and other places, where they have been able to preserve some of that wonderful, very rich African history. And I think it's actually preserved in more places than we know, but it's just covered over, or it looks like European, but it's not really.
Right.
And also in a lot of those islands, you had slaves that ran away or that the owners took to, you know, those particular areas and gave them their freedom. Kind of similar, I think, to those Jamaicans that the black Jamaicans that were there in Jamaica. The Europeans would come over, they would procreate with them, and then they would classify them as white, such that they could stay there in Jamaica and no one could take their land from them, which was their family land then. That was their other Jamaican family, and they might have another family up in Europe. And so they would classify them as white as opposed to being in America, even though they procreated with black or Africans here in the United States. They could not classify those children as white. They were black based upon the fact that they were born by, you know, the mother, which was, you know, kind of, you know, a bit different. And, and also one of the things that the United States that we were always taught was that one of the things that a man is to do is to get out and be adventuresome and forge on his own. And if you don't make the guy go out and, you know, forge on, not Paul Bunyan, but Davy Crockett, a Davy Crockett kind of person, that he will not function as a man at some point in time. Now, I would assume it depends on how they're raised and all of that. But that was really the general principle behind that idea of he'll become a mama's baby, he'll never amount to anything. If you don't make him forge out on his own and become a man so that when he has his own family, he will be able to stand up as a man. And that was kind of how that whole thing, you know, came about in terms of you got to get him out your house. You can't just let him sit up in your house for the rest of their life or they won't amount to anything.
Yeah.
Which, as Margaret is talking about, the other side is you make sure to take care of him until there's something really, really out there. Right.
I call it the Americanization of Margaret because, you know, I didn't know much about what was happening or what had happened in the U.S. when I came here. So, you know, I came here sort of green and fresh, which was a good thing for me because I thought I was more or less insulated from a lot of things that might have been obvious to someone else.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it was not obvious to me. And I just, you know, walked right over it and head in the direction, whatever direction it was my goal to get to. So,
and you achieved.
Yes. So as far as I'm concerned, I am very happy, you know, that the fact that I was born and raised in Jamaica, although, you know, I've left there for so long. I've lived longer in the United States, and I've been an American citizen since 1966. However, and I must tell you that I'm really exploring and celebrating more of my culture now that I'm retired and I'm a senior's senior than I did when I was busy raising my family, you know, and integrating into the American system. But I know that my mother and her mother before her and her mother before her, because I was privileged to meet my great-grandmother, and not my grandmother. My grandmother died young. And, you know, they had no, I don't remember any of them having any issues with being second class or different. You know, we have a big class system or had in Jamaica when I was growing up. But within the middle class or the upper class, as long as you were, you know, economically in that position everybody makes together, whether they're very dark or very light. And what, I don't know, Doctor, if that was your experience when you were growing up, because, you know, you grew up in a different period than I did.
That was still, particularly at Campion, that was still clear. The cult, everyone blended together, but the class distinction was definitely there. So when I went to Campion, Annabella Ciaga was there and others. And so it was clear that the bulk of the people who had the money to send their children there were of a certain color,
right.
But there was not any kind of explicit racial conversation going on. I know that my friends who were from Augustown and Ellison Flats had more challenges at the school because
right.
It was clearly an upper crusty school.
So did they have the challenges because of their shades or because of where people knew where they were coming from?
Their class. It was all about class. So those
yeah,
of us who took JOS bus and minivan to school versus those who were dropped off as she was by the limo.
Right, I got you.
And it happened to fall along color lines, but it was not exclusively so.
Right.
Doctor, how about the girl-boy situation?
Pardon me?
How about the girl-boy situation? Because Campion is an offshoot of St. George's. St. George's was an all-boys college.
Yes,
Campion.
Yes. When I was at Campion between 80 and 83, it was co-ed.
Ah.
Yes, and that was very, very, very interesting. We had lots of St. Hugh's girls who were always very, very present.
Oh. See, in my day, you didn't have co-ed schools.
That was a bigger issue than other things.
Yes, very much. The gender, keeping the gender separate. And now they're doing research and finding out that actually does improve how children's ability to learn.
Really?
The gender separation at the younger, particularly the teenagers.
Yes, yes, yes. In other words, it's better to have the separation?
It's better to have the separation because they learn better.
Uh-huh.
And there's recent research out of education that is showing that.
Right. I think so, and I wish they had paid more attention to that in Jamaica. I hope they will, because I think that there has been sort of a breakdown of the standards.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've heard from, for instance, some of my friends have been, you know, that are from Mannings when it was Mannings. I don't remember if it was co-ed during those days, but schools that were, you know, female or male, now they're mixed.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like the standards or the grades are not as good as they were when they were exclusively male or female.
Yes. Yeah,
because I think during those teenage years when children or young people, you know, are going through all the hormone changes and, you know, experimenting and things like that, it makes it more difficult.
Yes. And I would say that it's probably a combination of factors, because there was also something about the schools under colonialism. And I don't want to sound like I'm a fan of colonialism. But in terms of education, there were definitely, it was different. And in many ways, people remembered things more because of the way that education was done.
Exactly. So I definitely believe that. And I know I have friends who are, you know, teachers or were teachers, and they could see the difference in the students that would come up like 10 years ago. You know, from Jamaica, and to integrate into the American system.
Yes.
Seems like they were more focused.
Mm-hmm.
They were, you know, sort of a higher intellectual level, you know, than they are now.
Yes.
And I think that is a shame, because, you know, education is really so important. It really, really is the basis of even... Yeah, but they're telling us that our time will soon expire, so I want to thank all our listeners for being here, and especially thank the doctor for sharing with us this evening. And want to ask her right now if she enjoyed it enough to be back with us.
Absolutely, 100%
sure. All right. Well, we hope you'll be a regular, and perhaps we can schedule it once a month or once every 6 weeks to just come and lavish with us.
Yes, and I would read some Louise Bennett once in a while, too.
Of course, we'd love that. And what city are you located?
Nashville, Tennessee.
Oh, way down with the cowboy. What do they call those people? What's the name of the
country music stars?
Right, country music. I love country music. There's always such a story to their songs.
And lots of Jamaican people love country music.
Oh,
we can
I love
about another time too.
Yes. We'll talk about that another time. But I want to thank all our listeners for being with us. And again, Doctor, I want to really tell you how much we appreciate you being here.
Yes.
Thank you, Donna. Thank you, Matt.
And
great.
We'd like to invite you to go to Backyard Labrish and become a member of our community. Perhaps we can learn a lot from you, and we just really appreciate what you're doing.
Thank you, and it's wonderful to talk to all three of you.
All right. We have a lot of other callers. I want to thank them for being with us. And although you didn't raise your hands, we ask you to come back and visit with us next week. And check us out our website at www.backyardlabrish.com. And if you all want to shout out good night to the doctor, please do so.
Good night from New York, the home of the Yankees.
All right. Go Yankees.
Bye.
We won't talk about our team, right, Donna?
What can you say? Atlanta Hawks.
Sorry.
Well, thank you very much, everyone, for listening. And, Doctor, please have a great week and a great year.
Thank you so much,
and God bless.
Same. Good night, everyone.
Good night. See you all next week. Same time, same station. Bye-bye. This is The Backyard, and we're just laying back in our chairs, and right now we're just going to chill and go off to sleep. So please have a wonderful evening, whatever you do, and remember to check us out in the backyard. Bye-bye.